Welcome to everybody. P.J. O'Rourke, first of all, let me tell you why he's here or how he came to come here. We have a friend in common, Jim Denton, who visited here some months ago. Jim Denton being the former head of Freedom House and the publisher of World Affairs. P.J. and I were at Jim Denton's house in Washington some months ago, and Jim Denton was raving about RFE. And said, I was there, it's spectacular, PJ, you have to go. PJ said, well, you know, of course I know RFE, it's this great and famous institution from the Cold War, but I confess I don't know everything about what it's up to today. By the end of the evening, we had closed a deal, and here you are. PJ O'Rourke is a terrific and very important writer, a political essayist and satirist. He has written numerous books. He has produced television documentaries. He's been, you were editor-in-chief of National Lampoon, is that right? Okay, editor-in-chief of National Lampoon, if you know what that magazine is and has been. He's written for the Rolling Stone magazine. He's written for the Atlantic Monthly and a range of publications. And he is a fantastically interesting, engaging personality. He has... Where is Tinch's on home leave or on his way to Kyrgyzstan? He told me the other day that, yes, I know Kyrgyzstan a little bit. I was on a two-week horseback riding trip there once. He has been a war correspondent. He's covered Somalia and any number of other things. He's going to talk a little bit about 20 minutes or so about the connection, the link between communication and liberty and freedom, and then we'll have at least 30 minutes for Frank Williams to moderate a fabulous discussion. Thank you, PJ, and thank you, Frank.
Well, thank you. And I was a little puzzled when Jeff asked me to brief you on what I would be able to brief you about, you know. And I think really, rather than attempting to brief you, you should think of me as just one more U.S. taxpayer basically... you know, lecturing you about what you should do. which brings up the question of what does Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, what does it do? What do all of you do, you know? And I think if we ask Congress or the State Department or even the President, that they would all say that you promote democracy. But to me... this is both an oversimplification of what you do, and at the same time, it makes the job that you do too complicated, too difficult, even impossible. I mean, well, first, the oversimplification, because promote democracy makes democracy sound like a brand of fast food, McDonald's, you know, and you're supposed to sell it, you know, and Congress and the State Department and the President can measure how much of this you've sold. And some congressman can come here and may have done so already or will in the future and say, well, I thought you'd been promoting the heck out of democracy in Iran, you know? And all of a sudden, sales are flat, you know? What is the matter with you people? But obviously, democracy is not a Big Mac, you know? It's not something that everyone loves the moment that they taste it, especially not the people who are in power in the place where it's being tasted. And simply, as all of you know very well, not that simple. But on the other hand, the idea of promoting democracy is also too complicated. Great thinkers have been promoting democracy since ancient Athens. So you are expected to do overnight what all the geniuses in the world haven't been able to do in 2,500 years. You know? America, it's the greatest military power in the history of the world. America has been promoting democracy using this military power in Iraq and Afghanistan. There have been, as you may have noticed, some problems with that promotion of democracy. But you are expected to do, with a cheap transistor radio, what the U.S. Army hasn't been able to do with billions of dollars of guns and bombs and planes and helicopters and drones and so forth. No, so. See, what I think that you do, in my mind, what you do, is both more simple and more complex than promoting democracy. You are communicating. You are giving information to the world, to some of the least free places in the world. And I think the information that you communicate is the essence, the soul, if you will, of the attitude of liberty, the feeling of being free. Now, people must feel free of physical and economic oppression, of course. But first, they must feel free of ignorance. I mean, the blindfold has to be taken off. People have to be able to look around. You know, even if you're locked in a room, you are more free in that room with the lights on than you are in that room with the lights off, you know, when you're going to smash into the furniture at any moment. This attitude of liberty, it's powerful, the sense that you have some knowledge, some understanding, and therefore some control, if only control over your own ideas, you know. The greatest strength of America is not military, it's not diplomatic. The greatest strength of America is its idea, the idea of a place where people have information, have understanding, and have therefore some control over their lives. And this was brought home to me very early on as a foreign correspondent. And the very, very first war zone I ever visited was Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War, 1984. And I am going around Beirut quite ignorant and quite lost, and I get caught on the south side of Beirut at a Hezbollah checkpoint manned by a bunch of teenagers. Teenagers with guns and Kill America Satan Devil T-shirts, you know? And they demand my passport, and they see that I am American. I think they obviously knew anyway that I was American. And this one kid starts, first he's flipping this gun around, and the use of the safety on a gun is just unknown in Lebanon. And he's digging the muzzle into the dirt and scratching his ear with his gun, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, the gun safety merit badge must go begging in the Lebanese Boy Scouts. And then he starts pointing this gun at me and waving the gun at me and screaming at me about America, Satan, devil, about how America is responsible for the civil war in Lebanon, and America is responsible for the international Zionist conspiracy, and America is responsible for all the poverty and war in the world and all of the oppression and everything. And really for 15, 20 minutes, he yells at me about these things. And then he hands my passport back, and he says, as soon as I get my green card, I am going to Michigan to study dentist school. And I'm thinking, this is 25 years ago, you know. Today, that guy, you know, he's a rich orthodontist in Dearborn, you know, who probably voted against Obama, you know, and is probably wondering what you're doing to promote democracy here with his tax dollars. You know. So information is the source of citizenship, you know. I mean, without information, no one can even try to build a civil society. And I see your role in this provision of information as especially important because you are trying to provide accurate information. We had this discussion with several of us here in the room about, I'm not going to say truth, that's going too far. I'm not even going to say objective information. I'm not sure there is such a thing. But there is such a thing as fact. There is such a thing as accurate information. You're doing your best to make information accurate. And as you do that, what you're doing is you're acting as a kind of scientific peer review committee, you know, putting information to the test to see if it's accurate. Now, what's important is not that you're always successful in this test of information accuracy. You couldn't be. No one could possibly be always successful with this. I mean, I speak as a reporter. We get things wrong. Ask General McChrystal, you know, about that. You know, we get things wrong. What is important is that attempt, the effort to achieve accurate information is what fights rumor, it fights conspiracy theories, it fights blood libels, it fights scapegoat hatreds. See, ignorance creates a worldview that is hostile to liberty, because ignorance, it excludes the information, the understanding, the sense of self-control that are necessary to feeling that you are a free person in your heart, no matter how much your body may be oppressed. You know, the communication of tested, reliable, accurate information, as accurate as can be made, as the information can be made, this communication is the basis of trust among individuals, trust that can be extended beyond family, beyond tribe, beyond clan, beyond a small group of associates. And this extension of trust is the basis of the agreements that are at the heart of a free and democratic society. We need communication because we need those agreements. But we also need communication because we need disagreements. An argument about issues, argument that is based on reliable and accurate information, this is also at the heart of a free and democratic society. It is by means of this kind of informed argument that those of us who live in free countries are able to do what I think of as fighting without killing, you know? In fact, you might even think of it as fighting without winning. In a democracy, no side wins forever. The other side can always come back later. And this is good, because that way the other side doesn't have to kill us if they lose. You know? And, you know, maybe the next time the other side will be right, because information keeps changing, and therefore ideas keep changing. And therefore, minds keep changing, and arguments keep being won and lost. There's a story about John Maynard Keynes, the economist. Somebody said to him, mocked him for changing his mind about something. He said, you're inconsistent. You said this in one thing you wrote, and then you said something the opposite. And Keynes said, when my information changes, I change my opinion. What do you do? And that's, you know, at the essence of that communication of, in democracy, these arguments, we don't call them war. You know, we call them politics. You know? Now, also to my mind, one more very important part of liberty is the free market. Not just because the free market makes people more prosperous, though it does do that. And certainly not because capitalism is always a wonderful thing. It often is not a wonderful thing at all. What is important about the free market, and what's important to liberty about the free market, comes back to what you do, communication. The free market is about information. Actually, the free market is just about one specific piece of information. The free market tells us what a given person will pay for a given thing at a given moment. Free market is not an ideology. It's not a creed. It's not something we take on faith. It is measurement. It provides one piece of information, one piece of information only, a measurement. It's a bathroom scale. Now, I may not like what I see when I step on the bathroom scale, but I can't pass a law saying that scale will read 70 kilos, you know? And totalitarian governments, they think they can pass that law. They think they can pass a law to change the measurement of things. The Soviet bloc didn't collapse because of Reagan or Thatcher or European missile bases or Star Wars. The Soviet bloc collapsed because of Bulgarian blue jeans. The free market was trying to tell the Kremlin that Bulgarian blue jeans were ugly. They didn't fit. They were badly made. people wouldn't wear Bulgarian. People wouldn't wear Bulgarian blue jeans, not literally to save their lives. You know? But the Kremlin wasn't listening, and the Berlin Wall came down. You know? Now, finally, communication makes one more great contribution to liberty. When you communicate with people, you are assuming an equality among people. Just talking to people indicates that those people are not people who aren't worth talking to. They can't be. You're talking to them, you know? So in a free society, all people must be communicated with, and all people must be able to communicate in return. People must be able to talk back. People must be able to communicate with the political structure. People must be able to communicate certain information to the leaders of the political structure, information such as, you're fired, you know? And this is one of the great things that you're doing here, is not just making yourselves heard, but you're making your listeners and your website visitors also heard. And this assumption of equality among citizens that you exemplify with your communications, this is the exact opposite of the exercise of arbitrary power. The exercise of arbitrary power means that some people aren't worth talking to. They're only worth killing, you know? To deny education to women, to deny political rights to minorities. This means some people aren't worth talking to. And if you won't even talk to people, obviously, then you're certainly not going to listen to them, you know? Liberty is listening. Liberty is people being heard when they say what kind of society they want to live in. And these simple and direct lines of communication that you have opened and that you spend all day keeping open, these lines of communication guide the way to democracy. So, yes, I mean, you do promote democracy. But it's the kind of democracy promotion that comes from the tongues of the people, you know, not the kind that is shoved down their throats, you know. And that's all I know. However, if anybody has any questions, I'll make some other stuff up.
Well, let me begin with a reflection. Humor is subversive. Yes?
Humor is subversive?
And
yes, yeah.
Yes, and your background suggests National Lampoon and also Rolling Stone that you are one of nature's subversives.
Certainly my parents thought so, or told me so over and over.
So what is the relationship between subversion? I mean, you've presented a fairly serious view of communication, and I somehow don't think that this matches with you as a natural subversive. That your form of communication is more subversive, for example, than the straightforward communication of certain sets of values. And I'd like to perhaps get some of your thoughts about how you would communicate with the peoples and the people that we communicate with, because straightforward communication of facts and opinion is possibly not your preferred way.
No.
Of operating,
no.
that you and in the old days when we were broadcasting, subversion was actually quite a natural form of activity. Subversion, intellectual subversion against the Soviet Union, was both interesting, fun, and useful. But subversion, kind of in a de-ideologized world, has a different kind of form, and maybe it's not so creative. I don't know. I'm just so. How would you operate?
Well, one of the problems that I would have, you know, if I were involved in Radio Free Europe, is that I hate dealing with organizations that I like and admire. I am all about tearing down. I'm not about building up. And I do believe subversion has its place, as it certainly did in the Cold War. I can't imagine, simply because one gigantic ideology has been more or less discredited and defeated, that I can't imagine that the world is without a great variety of very bad ideas, perhaps ideologies that go with those ideas. Maybe they're more splintered and they're more spread around now than they once were. But there are still a lot of bad ideas out there that are worth subverting. And there are a lot of ways to subvert them. I mean, humor is only one. And I'm not sure humor is by any means the most effective, but it can rob people of dignity. And sometimes dignity is the dignity and sense of self-importance is one of their most powerful tools. The people in the communist bloc before the Cold War ended were absolutely brilliant at taking the mickey out, as the Brits would say, taking the mickey out of their leaders, you know, of reducing the importance, the self-importance, the dignity, the sanctity of those leaders. I would be willing to bet that somewhere out there in Afghanistan, there are some tribes people telling the kind of jokes that make the Taliban look very foolish. I know for a fact that in Iran there are people telling jokes that make the Revolutionary Guard and all of their friends and pals look very foolish, to diminish them. It's a very small part of undercutting autocracy and oppression. It just happens to be the only part I know how to do.
I'd just like to say there's nothing worse, I think, than explaining comedy, or nothing unfunnier than explaining comedy. But it seems to me whenever people try to analyze it, they always say that what comedy is about, or humor, is undercutting rigidity or robot-like behavior in humans. And it seems to me autocrats, as you were saying, in Iran and elsewhere, are always there trying to impose rigidity, inflexibility, one version of things. And I know you say we're dealing with a post-ideological world in Russia, for example. But actually, one of the things that Putin has assiduously shut down is satire programs, successful satire TV. And certainly in other parts of the Soviet Union, as in Azerbaijan, we've just witnessed the imprisoning of two young blog creators who basically satirized policies of this very authoritarian regime. So I would say the need for the subversion in our region is strong. And I know we've dedicated programs to increasing satire and humor. And I just wonder if you might have any ideas. I know we have a very successful satire program in the Iran program, but if you would be our consultant in satire, I wonder if you have any. I wonder if you have any interesting ideas for that particular form of subversion that might be spread throughout our service, because I think it's always of value.
Well, there are a couple things that humor can do. I mean, when we say satire, we actually mean a very specific thing.
Right. I mean humor.
Well, no, but I mean satire has great value in dealing with oppressive regimes, because satire is the use of humor for moral purposes. There is a lesson in satire. There is, sometimes it's a negative lesson, sometimes it's a positive lesson, but it actually has a specific definition. There is a more general kind of humor that has a more general effect, and humor comes from the English and general European concept that human personalities were driven by the four humors. I can never, it's like the seven dwarfs, I can never remember them all. You know, there's yellow bile and phlegm and black bile and blood or something, I can't remember. But at any rate, that we had these constituent parts and that they dominated in one person. And in that sense, humor simply means to humanize people. And of course, humanizing people is an extremely valuable thing to do. When I was a foreign correspondent, 15 years, 20 years that I spent as a foreign correspondent, I would go to places and I would be funny about those places, not to make fun of the people there necessarily, but to show in part, I was just making jokes for the sake of making jokes, but so I don't want to oversell my mission. But one of the things that I was doing, whether I meant to do it or not, was showing that these people were humans just like us. And that regarding them, that we should not regard them as aliens. You know, when you go to mainland China, when you go to Iraq, when you go to Kuwait, even Saudi Arabia, you know, they're people just like us. And the moment that you turn them into human beings, even if you're just do it by kidding them, you have made a sort of step, a mental step that's very important to any sort of international, cosmopolitan sense of living in a world of fellow human beings. And, you know, this wasn't easy with the Saudis, I've got to say. They were not easy to humanize. And I was stuck in Saudi Arabia for a long time in the run-up to the Gulf War, to the first Gulf War in 91. And we had a standing bet in the press corps of a post-war bottle of champagne to anyone who saw a Saudi lifting anything heavier than money. I don't believe anyone won. But I did manage, you know, I mean, nonetheless, there were funny aspects to the society. And I'm driving down the highway between Dhahran and the very modern turnpike down Dhahran to Riyadh. And I stop at this very modern rest stop at a very modern gas station. And everything looks like it's out of the American West, that you might as well be in the American Western Desert. And it's a big American cars all over the place, the size drive. And I go to use the bathroom, and there it is, you know, perfect Exxon station American rest stop bathroom, you know, all sparkling clean and everything. And I look at the toilet, and on the toilet seat are two footprints, because the Saudis hadn't been able to figure out how to use the Exxon, you know, toilet station thing. You know? And these weren't poor Saudis, or they wouldn't be in cars on the highway. So some poor guy had been up there perched on that, thinking, this is the worst toilet in the world. You could kill yourself. So all of a sudden they became human, you know.
We get that sometimes here.
Bruce. They're not footprints, they're soul prints, but you find them here.
I have a comment and a question. The comment about the perception and accurate information. Very often when I tell people where I work and then I mention that it's funded by the U.S. government, they say, oh, you do propaganda. And I have to patiently explain that's not what we do. But essentially, there is that perception out there. And you know, going back to what you were saying at the beginning, you know, if we're ever seen as purveyors of American information rather than
information,
yeah, then we've lost. And I wanted to ask you about your perception. It was briefly mentioned at the beginning that you had a perception of this organization. Your perception of it now, having spent some time here, I'd like to ask you, what surprised and impressed you in a positive way since you've been here, but also as a good journalist, you must have had some skeptical or negative reaction to something you saw here, if you could share some of those.
Well, I didn't understand, as most people don't understand, the sort of welter of American government-funded news outlets. You know, I knew intellectually, I knew about the existence of Radio Free Europe. I wasn't quite clear about its relationship to Radio Liberty or to VOA. The tree of or for that matter, you know, I didn't know whether it was also tied in with the armed forces stuff, you know, which is obviously not. I mean, I think I could have, you know, I had an idea, but I didn't know, you know. I wasn't particularly concerned because I knew through our mutual friend Jim Denton I knew what you were doing. I don't think I understood before I got here the extent of it. I thought of it as a smaller operation. But my initial reaction when Jim and Jeff and I were talking about this is I said, you know, post-Cold War, I'll bet most Americans don't even know you exist anymore. I mean, they think of Radio Free Europe as an artifact of the Cold War. And you know, that's a very bad thing, very bad feeling. It would be dangerous for people to feel that what you did was propaganda. But it would be much more dangerous for people to feel that you weren't there at all. You know? So that's going to be hard to fund. Fund what? They still exist. As far as the propaganda goes, I think that there's always been a sense of sufficient confidence in the idea of liberty that the most powerful weapon was the truth. Certainly in the piece that I will do about this organization, I want to reassure people that it's not a propaganda organ. But I don't think that's their first thought. Americans have always had this sense that if we just show people how things are, you know, if we just give people information, or for that matter, when they're in something like VOA, when they're talking more about America, if we just show America as it is, people will understand, people will get it. I think that part of that comes not from arrogance on the part of Americans, but from the fact that we're an immigrant nation. And it isn't. I often tell people, you know, Americans don't like foreigners, and the reason Americans don't like foreigners is because we are foreigners. We know about foreign countries, you know? And if we'd wanted to stay foreigners, we would have stayed in the country we came from. You know? So, that's why we don't like foreigners. It's not xenophobia. It's not, you know, it's not, we don't regard them as aliens or strangers. You know, we regard them as cousins, and cousins we don't like. You know. But you know, I don't think that the main problem. In fact, they're probably in some ways you may face the problem back in the United States within Congress or elsewhere in the sort of political establishment of not being seen as propaganda enough. You know, I mean, there may be people in there saying, well, why aren't they out there, you know, pitching for America's policy positions, whatever they may be this week.
Thank you. TJ, a comment and then a question. Just for your information, the Berlin Wall didn't fall only because of the Bulgarian genes. It was also, I think, the Yugoslavian Yugo cars.
Yes. Yeah. They were certainly a factor.
You know, some of us are broadcasting to a different part of the world, not the Central or Eastern Europe, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and certainly Iran. And you refer to giving this information or providing this democracy and liberty to a dark room. You put somebody in a dark room, there's no light, but you're saying, here's democracy. We are broadcasting to that part of the world. We're giving not the objective information, but the accurate information and facts. But the problem is, on the other side where we're giving the information, they have two kinds of mindset. One, their mindset is set that I'm not going to take it. I don't accept this information because it's coming from you. I don't like you. The other thing is their level of understanding. They are in that dark room. Their perspective on things in world is quite different. So how do you come around this?
You know,
I know for a fact satire works. It has worked for us to some extent. But how do you get around that?
But, you know, the only answer to that is time. You know, when we look out at the world and we expect people to move very quickly to free society, to rule of law, to equality before the law, even to equality between the sexes and so on. You know, there's an arrogance in this. I mean, not all of us are European, let alone Western European, but we all share, as educated people, to a certain extent, a Western European mindset. Look how slow that process was in Western Europe. It began in the late Middle Ages. It didn't even really get started until the end of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment. look at the number of dead people that were required. And just about the time that the Western European mindset got to the point where almost everybody in this room would agree with today, where people began to really feel that the entire population had a right to an input on the nature of government, and that the entire population was equal before the law, and that reason should prevail in political policy, and so on and so forth. Western Europeans underwent a period from 1914 to 1945 of unbelievable slaughter of each other, an insane, pointless slaughter of each other. And then we ask the rest of the world, well, why are you misbehaving? Are we crazy? People are behaving like people around the world. The kind of trouble we face in most of even the worst places in the world, even Somalia, pales compared to something like World War I or the Holocaust. The chaos, the irrationality, and so on. So a lot of it is, we just have to keep at it. It won't be accomplished in our lifetimes. It won't be. It'll be generations. But that's no reason not to keep pushing in that direction. Time and circumstance, we hope, are on our side.
Can we go to Paul first? Can we go to Paul first? Yeah.
It's okay. Paul Tibbetts, I run our audience research program, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about the use of humor, not necessarily as subversion, but in the delivery of information. Because I'll admit, when I saw you in Jeff's office this morning, the first thing I did was close my eyes and listen to you talk because of the NPR show. And looking at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, long before Jeff told us you were coming, I suggested that we rip off the idea. Because of using humor to talk about daily news and events, and you can send things up a bit, but you're still commissioning information. You're still serious, and a lot of times our audiences tell us we're too serious. So taking more of a lighthearted look at the news and events, as is done on that particular show, for folks in the room who may not have heard it. Just kind of your thoughts.
I think this could be a good idea. Let me back up a little bit and explain what this is. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is an NPR news quiz show, and I'm one of the panelists. There's a large rotating panel. There are 20, 25 of us. Any given week, three of that pool will be on the panel. There's a fellow, Peter Sagal, who is the moderator, and then the announcer is Carl Castle from NPR. I'm sure many of you are familiar with for his years of news broadcasting this, in turn, I believe this show was actually ripped off from a British show of a similar type, and the idea is to be funny about the news, but also to do a news quiz with the panelists attempting to accumulate the most points, and we aren't very serious about winning usually. The show is probably a little bit more comedy-oriented than something that you might do. Probably has a little less. It's a little less concentrated on the current events of the week. It started out that way, and as the show has evolved over, say, 15 years, it has moved more toward a directly comic show about, and we concentrate more on very stupid news stories, on pizza shop burglars who eat so much pizza that they can't get back out the window they came in, and that kind of thing, which wouldn't necessarily apply. But the general idea of having a news quiz and taking a light and people making jokes about these things, what. To ask the question, what was Hillary Clinton doing? Where was she last week, and what was she doing? And then people to give possible funny answers, and then someone gives the correct answer. These things I think would be fun for an audience, and also act as a kind of light version of This Week in Review. And This Week in Review is one of those things that as I'm sure you all know, can be deadly dull. It's like working for a small-town newspaper and having to write deaths elsewhere. You know, I mean, it's, yeah, I think I can speak for NPR. Feel free. We stole it. You can steal it again.
Irina?
Actually, I don't think, I'm not sure that's a place where humor works particularly well as a tool. Because when you're dealing with very fundamental ignorance of the world, you have to start small. You have to start by convincing people that the world is comprehensible, that they can trust their own senses. I mean, if you think of the evolution of the intellect, you know, from why does that stream run downhill? Because the water nymph is making it run downhill. Well, maybe even if the nymph weren't there, it would run downhill. Well, why? if you think about how long it took people to figure out that the Earth went around the Sun instead of the Sun going around the Earth, you know. I'm not sure that humor is. I mean, perhaps it could be used as a tool, but it isn't the first thing I'd pull out of the toolbox when I was dealing with. The first thing is I think to let people know that they can trust their senses, that they can trust their reason, that they can think things through on their own. That if something, especially something in the civil political situation, if it doesn't seem to make sense, it probably doesn't make sense. The Russians were very lucky in that they were very well educated, and so they were perfectly aware that their system wasn't making sense. They didn't know quite what the alternative to that system might be, but they knew it wasn't making sense. But there are people out there, I'm sure there are people in Zimbabwe, who are really not aware that their system isn't making sense, and that the people talking to them aren't making sense, and that they are starving because of the Queen of England ate all their food, or something.
I'm from the Persian section of Fardo. One of the points that we are very proud of is the fact that in the past 12 years we've built up a sense of trust and confidence in people, in our listeners, for being impartial and balanced as well. Impartial in giving information and balanced in bringing different views, so that if we interview someone who holds one view, we make sure that if not the same time, definitely the next day, we will bring someone who has the opposite views. Now, as you've heard, we launched a very successful satire program. Some people from our listeners or even our colleagues are expressing some skepticism about the way that this can affect our reputation on being a balanced and impartial voice. And I believe that this can be dealt with, but there must be some ways of dealing with that. I'm all for a satire program, and I think humor is amazingly wonderful, does a wonderful job, and raises the, as you say, humanizes the society. What are your recommendations for maintaining that reputation through a satire program?
This is a valid and difficult question. It's a question, actually, that NPR had about things like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, because NPR had this very serious, very balanced, you know, very trustworthy. Some of us don't quite agree with that, you know, that NPR as kind of a mindset that belongs to American liberalism, and some of us who are not liberals don't think they're so balanced. But nonetheless, I'm sure you have the same problem in Iran. There is no getting around the fact that any sort of use of humor is going to offend some people. There are just some people who are very, very serious. Paula Poundstone is a very successful stand-up comedian in America, a very funny woman, said that there's nothing you can say that isn't going to hurt somebody. She would be doing an act where she was talking about Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz and Dorothy in the spinning house, you know, landing on the Wicked Witch, and somebody would come up to her after the show and say, "A house landed on my mother." You know? How can you make fun of that? You know, and it's just, you know, it's you are going to. One thing I think that is important to do is to how the program is framed, how it is set apart. It seems sort of painful at times to say, "Now we are kidding," and you think, "Ew." And yet, that kind of framing of a situation is often necessary to get people to change mindsets, you know. And then, I mean, you know, it really is when you are engaged in a serious task, this isn't always the appropriate tool. I mean, sometimes you're fixing a wristwatch with a hammer, you know, when you use humor. It does, however, have a very valuable place, not only in terms of subverting certain kinds of authorities and being able to tell truths. You know, sometimes you can tell a truth with a laugh. Horace actually has a quote to that. You know, what stops a man who can laugh from telling the truth? There are things you can say. It has its value about that, but does it also undercut your mission? Can the subversive attitude spread to everything? I mean, we like, or we say we like somebody who is funny, but everybody is annoyed by someone who is a constant wise ass, you know, who has always got a crack about it. Gets tiring, you know, after a while. So there's a kind of painful restraint that goes into. But one of the values that it has, aside from the things that it can do intellectually, is simply keeping the audience's attention. You know, there is something to be said just for making sure the audience is paying attention. You know, I mean, people like this; they're drawn to it, even when they're upset by it a little bit. They're drawn to it. And so, you know, it's a valuable tool for building audience if it's used right, but not without its dangers.
Yeah, we might actually be interesting for once instead of just the boring station. Okay. One more question from down the bottom.
Thank you. Salome Asatiani from the Georgian Service. I also think there is no doubt about satire and political satire being one of the most powerful, and I would say maybe if not the most powerful weapons there is. But we also know from history, and also some people have written about satire or carnival or humor even being used to let the steam or discontent out, certainly in societies that we call democratic and free and developed, but also sometimes in places and settings which we would not even characterize as such. Like we know even in medieval times there were carnivals when once a year peasants were allowed to impersonate the kings and poke fun at the king, but next day everything went back to normal.
Yes.
And the equilibrium was restored. So satire in this setting actually helped the system reproduce itself because the discontent was sort of let out. So what can we say about this?
It's absolutely true. It's a it is a wise authoritarian regime that allows a certain amount of fun to the people that it oppresses. I think that there was very little attempt, especially late in the history of the Soviet bloc, to suppress the kind of humor, because I think that leadership was sufficiently sophisticated to realize that this was a safety valve, a cheap safety valve, and a safe. Yeah, yeah. And right here in the Czech Republic, it was certainly one of the famous centers of that. You know, after 68, one of the things, the Czechs were allowed to make a little more money, and they were allowed to be funnier. You know, that was their payback for having tanks in the street. You know? So, there absolutely is that danger, and that is why I wouldn't urge on you any kind of humor that is simply frolicsome. You know, that simply lightens the tone, because that really doesn't go anywhere. You know, I would say that an organization like this does need to concentrate on satire, not necessarily the most biting or vicious satire, but satire meaning humor that does have a point of view. I mean, it does go with the general moral and intellectual compass that you're providing, and you know that underlies the communication of information. Also, would need to underlie the kind of humor. So, something like spitting images from Britain would be utterly inappropriate. You know, something that would just undercut every form of authority, made fun of every prominent person, whether they're a good prominent person or a bad prominent person, whose idea was just like the humor of some adolescents is just utterly destructive. You know.
It was extremely successful in Russia. The Russian counterpart of...
Well, actually, the Russians probably needed...
It was shut down by Putin.
Yeah, yes, I remember that because of the puppet of him, you know, which wasn't even one of their least flattering puppets, actually. Yeah.
PJ, before we close, you have a new book coming out, and you have to explain its title to this group, because you started by saying you're delighted to be here. It's an institution of democratic values that supports and promotes democracy, near and dear to your heart. And in September, you publish a new book titled Don't Vote, It Only Encourages the Bastards.
Yes, I have a little explaining to do there. First place, I'm kidding. But the second place is it's actually some years ago, about 20 years ago now, I wrote a book called Parliament of Whores, which was the subtitle was A Lone Humorist Attempts to Explain the Entire United States Government. And I went to Washington, I lived in Washington, and I wrote about all the branches of government and how huge and silly they are and can be. So I had wanted for a long time to write a kind of book of political theory to go with the book of political practice that I wrote, and the message in the title for Americans is the danger, I think, in over politicizing a society in regarding politics as the answer to every conceivable problem in society. A problem, of course, well known from the left, but also a problem that obtrudes on the right. Conservatives in America or Tea Party movement in America will protest vigorously against all sorts of expansion of government, and yet they want an anti-abortion constitutional amendment, or they want a whole series of laws about how a woman can get an abortion, or they want a whole series of laws about what constitutes marriage and who can be married to each other. And, you know, my message to them has always been, be careful of what you wish for. You know, you may get the Federal Department of Marriage, but you won't always control it. Someday there's going to be a gay couple running the Federal Department of Marriage, and you're going to be sorry. You know, don't take something that is primarily a social issue and turn it into primarily a political issue. And I think, you know, this is something that a problem that Europe has wrestled with that you see at a very basic budgetary level. I mean, their entitlement programs are so huge that even though they are incredibly rich countries, they're left with very little discretionary money to, say, send troops to Afghanistan. No, we can't afford that, you know, because everybody's got to retire at 38, you know. And we have to pay for that. So, now, mind you, I'm not saying they would send troops to Afghanistan anyway, but it gives them a built-in excuse. So the don't vote is meant to discourage the idea of the infinite expansion of the political realm. And this is, you know, a message that isn't really particularly germane to a lot of places that need an expansion of a democratic political realm into different parts of it. A lot of you are dealing with places that are in a kind of chaos or a kind of authoritarian arbitrary exercise of power that could use an expansion of a rational political system. But then there are those of us who could use a contraction of that same rational.
Well, let me say this in close. First of all, PJ said that he wanted to get to know RFE, and he spent two great days here. He's going to be here this afternoon. He's going to join us at 5 o'clock for ice cream and beer on the deck outside. But when he said he wanted to get to know RFE, he really meant he wanted to get to know RFE. He is leaving tomorrow for Afghanistan, where he will spend 3 days with our bureau there. I thank you very much for that initiative and that interest, and Akbar and Hashim for hosting him there. Frank, terrific job. And PJ O'Rourke, thank you. Wonderful.